So I was given the task to talk about peace and pacifism, one of these questions that you all are wrestling with. And I decided that I would, instead of offering solutions or answers, as if I have any, I would just share some stories about my own wrestling with peace and what does it mean to live out our witness for peace here in our community. So I mostly have some stories to share with you all to help maybe complicate how we think about peace, and also invite you into thinking about prisons as one of the hallmarks of violence of our carceral society. Let's pray. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be pleasing and acceptable to you, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer, the one who redeems our words and our thoughts, and the one who will redeem this world. Amen. So in Jeremiah 29, this passage we just heard, we have a clipping from a letter that has made its way into our Bible. A letter that the prophet Jeremiah wrote to his people who had been taken into Babylonian exile. In the letter, Jeremiah tells them to make peace with their situation, to give up on their dreams of a return to their homeland and make the best of what they've got where they are, to make a home in that foreign land, to build homes and plant gardens. And perhaps even most shocking of the exhortation, for them to seek the peace of their conqueror's society, to labor for the well-being of Babylon, Jeremiah says. Seek the peace of the city where I have sent you into exile, Jeremiah says on behalf of God. For in its peace, you will find your peace. That's the passage I think about as we try to sort through our lives in this society. That song from Bob Marley always comes to my mind, Babylon System from the 1970s. Do people listen to Bob Marley anymore? I don't even know. To keep this our social system running, our ordinary lives depend on a kind of exile called incarceration, where people are removed from their homes. Prisons maintain an order that makes all of our lives possible. So despite the fact that we try to separate people incarcerated from us, our lives depend on them in those prisons. The laws that promise our society and comfort, promise our safety and comfort, depend on the threat of incarceration. You obey the law because you don't want to be sent to prison. The United States imprisons 2 million people. That's a little more than the entire population of Phoenix, Arizona, and just a little bit less than the population of Houston, Texas. If we're committed to the peace of this country where we find ourselves, to the people around us, to the people exiled from us in prisons and in detention centers, if we find our peace in their peace, as Jeremiah says, how do we make sense of the contradictions of our lives, of our beliefs, commitments to peace? The contradiction that to be for the welfare of prisoners involves being against the welfare of the society that builds prisons, a way of life that depends on incarceration. What does it mean to be committed to peace here in this place where God has put us, where God has called us, when violences hold it all together? That's what I wrestled with every week when I was going to Central Prison here in Raleigh to teach classes there in prison. When I'd enter that prison every week for my class I was teaching, on the announcement board in the cell block where I taught my class, there was a sign for the prisoners who would pass by and for anybody else. Whenever they left their individual cells and they went to the classroom, they'd pass by this announcement board. On the sign, in big block letters, they had the prison administration or guards or whoever put the first line of the Serenity Prayer, prayer that's important for 12-step programs. The sign said, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Reinhold Niebuhr wrote those words as part of a longer prayer, which he used in his sermons in the 1930s. His prayer was picked up by Alcoholics Anonymous, then Narcotics Anonymous, and now is part of a variety of important recovery programs. The whole line, the whole thing, the whole prayer, as hopefully some of you know, is this: God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. So all of those things, serenity to accept what you can't change, courage to change what you can, and wisdom to know the difference. But there in Central Prison, the sign just had that first part of the prayer, a reminder that they can't change the reality of their incarceration. So they should get used to it, to accept the facts that they cannot change, facts like iron bars, concrete walls, fences, and razor wire. I've thought about that sign a lot because I saw it every week back when I taught those classes. The announcement board was outside the classroom, just around the corner from the metal door and reinforced plexiglass that of the windows of the classroom where we met. The class I taught there was on spiritual autobiography, where we read Malcolm X, Assata Shakur, George Jackson, Jimmy Baca, Nawal al-Assadawi, and the Apostle Paul, all people who wrote from captivity, from prisons. I'd chosen these readings to show the prisoners that they weren't alone, that there's a long tradition of people who write from imprisonment, writing to loved ones, writing to friends in other facilities, writing to the public about their situation, their condition, writing to fight against the isolation of incarceration, writing as an attempt to find solidarity and companionship, to share wisdom. And some of those writings made their way into our Bibles: Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, Philemon, all prison letters. So that was my reasoning for the class. But the prison administration, they had a different reason for letting me in their facility. And that had to do with what they imagined was the nature of spirituality, which had everything to do with that prayer outside the classroom. Serenity, to accept things as they are, to be peaceful, to be docile. The work of religious professionals was to encourage that posture. Pastors as spiritual guides for learning how to submit to control, as motivation to do the time with purpose, to do the time and not let the time do you. Around the same time as I was teaching these classes, a very important theologian and priest, Sarah Coakley, had been leading prayer groups up in Massachusetts, in a prison in Massachusetts. She was teaching the prisoners contemplative prayer as part of her own research and interests, instructing them in that ancient Christian tradition of silent prayer. After one of the sessions, one of the prisoners came up to her. She recounts this in a story she wrote, and said this: "I get it," he said. "This is to make me patient. This is the opposite of drugs." Coakley talked about the purpose of her class as instilling, in her words, gentleness, poise, and peace. These were indeed manifest ways of bucking the system, if only for a short and blessed interval in that prison day. That's how she talked about what she was up to. To sit in a cell in silent prayer as bucking the system also meant that she was helping to teach the prisoners how to be good prisoners, how to just sit in their cells, to be non-disruptive and compliant, easy to manage in their serene acceptance of their miserable confinement, a life that they cannot change. So Sarah Coakley got me thinking about my own class in prison. I was doing the same kind of thing. I was just helping and subduing prisoners. Central Prison takes pride in maintaining a highly disciplined, orderly facility, as punitive as necessary to convince prisoners that it's worthless to act out, pointless to organize reforms, that they should just accept the violence of the facility as their only option for their well-being, for peace, starved of life. A student once told me once that there, when I was teaching a class there, one of the students told me that once, decades ago, there was a prison riot in Central Prison, only one in its long history. It happened a few years before the notorious uprising in the Attica prison in New York. In 1968, at Central Prison, 500 prisoners went on worker strike for their from their mandatory work requirement. There was an industries facility, as they called it, built inside of the prison, where the warden took on contracts with the state for license plates manufacturing and printing operations to make a little extra money. As you probably already know, forgive the repetition of these facts, but the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which abolished slavery in 1865, also authorized slave labor in prisons. So forced labor shifted from the plantation to the prison. So on April 17th, 1968, in the afternoon, the prisoners at Central Prison stopped working and began a sit-in to protest the living conditions in the old worn-down facility. It's a Gothic-styled fortress built in 1884 by prison labor. So if you're interested in the timeline, the North Carolina State Constitution mandated the building of the prison for the state in 1868, 3 years after the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. I assume that the U.S. Amendment sparked the process in North Carolina to build a prison. Where would they put formerly enslaved people to do labor? The sit-in lasted there in 1968, lasted through the night for 14 hours until the guards responded with batons and guns. The back and forth lasted for the rest of the day, with the incarcerated prisoners, protesters, burning down one of the wings of the prison and the guards killing six prisoners. 75 people were wounded, including victims on both sides. However, in the aftermath, the prison administration finally made changes to address some of the grievances. Less than 10 years later, on June 15th in 1975, the prisoners in the women's facility down the road protested their working conditions with their own sit-in. Some of you all lead worship in the women's prison. Is that true? You all still do that? Yeah, so that's the prison. So this is 1975. So they protested their working conditions with their own sit-in. Their unpaid labor took place in the laundry facility that was built inside of the prison. The women doing the laundry, the women were forced to do the wash of 35 state institutions, including at the time all of the tuberculosis sanatoriums. The prisoners were getting sick and they weren't provided with medical care. So 150 women inside the facility went on strike. This is Ann Willett, one of the prisoners. She explained why they went on strike. "Our reasons were to be recognized as human beings and not animals in a cage," she said. The warden responded by calling the guards from the men's prison up the road, up the hill, who responded with brutal force. No one died, but many women were wounded. The main organizers of the sit-in were transferred to solitary confinement miles away in men's facilities. Ultimately, however, they succeeded in permanently closing down the laundry facility in their prison. The beginning of the end for me in terms of teaching classes in Central Prison was when I was invited to a guest lecturer to a class that I was leading on death row. I was teaching classes at death row at the time. My guest teacher for that week was an important professor from a local institution. I won't say his name, who talked about historically how it hasn't proven very helpful for oppressed people to think about violence as a moral issue, but instead to think about it more practically, as whether or not violence is going to work, if it's going to get you what you want. The pragmatics of violence, he called it. So, for example, staging a riot in prison might not be a good idea, he said, not because it's wrong morally, but because the pragmatics of it all, the imbalance in terms of which weapons the prison has, which weapons the prisoners have, which weapons the guards have. You'll just lose. The prisoners would lose and lose miserably and would lose any of the privileges that they had gained over the years. So it just wouldn't work. Don't do it. While he was lecturing, apparently the program director of the prison was listening in. And as you can imagine, prison administrations frown upon conversations about riots and violence with prisoners. especially with people on death row who have little to lose in terms of their future. So they sit in their cell year after year, some of them for decades, becoming accustomed to their looming execution, learning the serenity to accept what they cannot change, to make peace with their violent situation. Obviously, our lives are very different from theirs. Life in prison seems like a world apart from mine, from ours. But the question I'm left with that I'm still beginning to struggle, finding an answer, that I'm sharing my struggles with you all here, is how do we make peace with this world, this configuration of our world, this world that includes them and us, a society that works only because we have prisons, that we do this to people. The prophet Jeremiah invites us to consider what makes for peace, for mutual welfare, for a world where my life and yours are bound up in goodness for ourselves and for our neighbors, and even perhaps for our enemies, for this version of Babylon that we have now to somehow be different. To think of ourselves as in exile here, in exile with Jeremiah, is to recognize that we aren't in control of the powers that be. We aren't the movers and shakers. We aren't the power brokers of Babylon, of this society. So we aren't those power brokers. So we have to make do with what we've got, with the life that we have, with our unfulfilled desires for a redeemed world. How do we live and act when we aren't in control of the world around us, and we can't pick up the phone and change it, even though we want to be in control, because we love our neighbors, we love this world, we want to build homes and plant gardens, we want a community of peace that includes everybody. One last story. In the middle of the federal prison in Butner, which is about, 30-minute drive, 20-minute drive north of us, there in Butner, I used to teach some classes as well. When you'd walk in, there's kind of a grassy area between the housing units. And when I'd walk in, I'd notice that there's kind of in the corners of the sidewalks, there were little patches of gardens. There's white and purple phloxes, baptisias, tulips, daffodils, witch hazel, forsythia, these little plots of garden for people in exile. I got to know the gardener. He was a prisoner in one of my classes. He'd been there incarcerated for over a decade. Over the years, being incarcerated there, he had noticed flowering plants sneaking their way at the edges of the facility through the fencing, sending their seeds inside the prison, sneaking their way through the layers of razor wire fences and into the compound. So he saw them, and when guards weren't looking, he transplanted them. He started making a home for them in the prison, life escaping the grip of concrete and fences and iron gates. He told me when I asked about why he was doing this, why he made these little gardens, he told me he was trying to make a home despite it all, to change the things that he could, to plot out a habitat for beauty, for warmth, in the middle of his cold, ugly world, a world that was out of his control, but was his home and the home of others nonetheless.